Hi guys, welcome back to part two, episode 162 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. I am back already. A lot of you are loving this episode, loving tentative term, but you've got a lot of thoughts. And considering there won't be an episode this coming week, I'll be back the following week because I'm recording this like Sunday. Because I've got quite a lot on this week that I have to use my mental capacity for, unfortunately. I'll be back the following week. So I wanted to come back and share with you the rest of this and not keep you hanging too long. A few ideas tossed around so far by patrons in Patreon. Jamie K said, is it possible like she hallucinated? What was going on as a combination of all of the factors, you know, that was happening at the time. Jay didn't elaborate on his comment really, other to say that he had his idea nailed down for a few years and it was psychedelic Siberian mushrooms, which actually isn't totally out of the realm that it could have been something that they consumed. We just don't know. So to put together what I think happened. I did a lot of medical journal reading for this, and this is going to be a very medical episode and probably on par with the Everest episode I did for Francis Arsentiev in terms of talking about different things that were going on. I actually love reading medical journals. It's a newfound thing as much as it makes me paranoid. And I've learned so much over the last 2 years, mainly like to help myself with my condition, but then I go off on tangents and I've just learned so much, and I find it fascinating learning about how your body is such a finely honed machine that if one thing is off, it can be a domino effect of other things being off. And how I've honestly, it sounds wanky, but I've walked away thinking the human body is an incredible thing, how it operates, and how it sends out warning signs for when it's malfunctioning, and we should learn what those are. So I looked at also what precipitated this event to kind of get an idea for myself, and looked at kind of experiences that they all shared in the lead up to this event, which I talked about on part one. So if you haven't listened to part one, you have to. We talked about this group going hiking and how the lone survivor ended up witnessing basically in her mind in a number of minutes, all of the people around her, six people, all bleeding from the eyes, the ears, vomiting blood, collapsing, having seizures, foaming at the mouth and dying. And we talked about how the autopsy said hypothermia. And one of the things that I was thinking when I was talking about all this was something that Jamie Kay brought up. She said, is it possible that all of Valentina, the sole survivor's recollections are actually she's rammed them all together in her mind when they actually happened over a period of hours or a day? And that's something that actually came into question for me. As much as I actually believe everything that Valentina recollects, but the only question I have is, did they happen minutes apart or did they happen hours apart? Because the human mind is so complex. And so I wanted to start by talking about a little bit about memory that I've read, and I was reading extensively about it, and just the concept of memory and how it works, you know, in the hippocampus and everything is such a complex thing. So NAADAC in the United States has talked about on their website, and I read a lot of different sources about how trauma affects memory. And they said, quote, trauma can shut down episodic memory and fragment the sequence of events. The hippocampus is responsible for creating and recalling episodic memory. Trauma can prevent information like words, images, sounds from different parts of the brain from combining to make a semantic memory. And from what I was reading, essentially you could say that what she witnessed, she's seeing it in flashes and in her mind. It all happened within minutes of each other. Now, the bodies were all found in the positions that she said it happened. So I've walked away thinking that most likely Valentina did witness it over the course of time and the way that she actually describes it. And according to Levine, Freud and Birrell in 2013, quote, while our brains are wired to remember experiences important to survival, under some circumstances, survival may be assisted by forgetting, unquote. And so it really comes down to
the makeup of your brain, and there's no why or wherefore as to how different brains work and how they're going to handle it. But generally, memory is, it's such a complex thing, because your brain says, I'm going to remember that because I may need it for survival later on, or I may need to recount that later on. And that's how memory forms, which is so interesting to me, because I have some really, you know, memories of childhood and stuff that you would think, why would I need to remember that so distinctly? But the likelihood is that memory of being at my grandparents or something didn't really happen the way it played out. I've kind of fragmented it, not that it was traumatic, it was a lovely memory, but for some reason I've stored it for a reason. And music in that is different, because it's stored in a different part of the brain. But I was thinking about this because when I was a little girl, because it's going to sound like I grew up in Pollyannaville, when I would be in the kitchen with my gran, who I've talked about on previous episodes, she would sing this song and we would sing it together. And after she died, when I was a teenager, that song was gone from my memory. And it actually caused a lot of stress for me, because I tried and tried constantly to think of it. I would ask my mum, I would ask family members, what was the song that gran always sang? And I was like, if you just give me two lyrics of it, I'll be able to know the rest. It's just been removed from my mind. And I know every lyric, it's there, it's embedded there somewhere, I just can't get to it. And I would force myself to try to remember this song. And then about 5 years ago, when I was, you know, 30 years old, I woke up one day and I had the lyrics, the first few lyrics in my mind. And it was an old song called Keep Young and Beautiful. And actually, Annie Lennox does a version of it. And I woke up and the lyrics were there, and I just started saying them out loud to myself. And I started crying, because I was like, where did that come from? Was that fed to me in my sleep? Did my brain spit that out during my sleep? And I went and I wrote it down, and because I was terrified it was going to go again. And I knew every single lyric to that song. And I still do. I know every verse, just purely through whatever happened in my sleep that night, 15 years after my gran died, or almost 15 years after my gran died, it came to the surface. And so when I was reading about recollection and recovered memory, I was like, that is so funny, because I read a study that said recovered memory years later can actually be as reliable as memory told an hour after an event happened. And I was like, yeah, well, all the lyrics were right of that song. So really interesting. Now, there's also another thing called memory amplification, which I found really interesting. And Southwick and Al did a study where they spoke to veterans of Operation Desert Storm, and they spoke to them 1 month after the event and 2 years after the event, and they compared what their recollections were. And they found that 88% of veterans had changed their response as to what they recalled for at least one event during, you know, their service. 61% changed more than one recollection, which is why eyewitness accounts are often not great, especially the more that time goes on. And it's up to you whether or not you believe that you're better off talking to someone immediately after a traumatic event to get information, or later on. But they did say that the majority of these changes in response were from no, that didn't happen to me, front to yes, that happened to me. And this is called memory amplification. And memory amplification is when you remember things worse than what they actually were. And this is a really common thing with memory. And in addition to blocking memories, trauma can actually lead to hyper remembering events where every single detail is in your mind. You can even remember, there's even like semantic memory where you can remember smells, and if you smell that again later on, it recovers that memory. And I think everyone has been through that. And this group, and the jury's out because everyone's research is different, they found that an intense negative emotion like a trauma, like what Valentina went through, is more likely to be encoded in the brain than a non-traumatic memory. Now, Richard McNally, who's a psychologist at Harvard, and he wrote a book called Remembering Trauma, literally about the recollection of traumatic memories. He talks about this, and he said, quote, the stress hormones, cortisol, norepinephrine, norepinephrine that are released during a terrifying trauma tend to render the experience vivid and memorable, especially the central aspect, the most meaningful aspects of the experience for the victim. So essentially, whether it's someone who has been raped or people who have served in the military or people who have survived watching someone being killed or survivors of a natural disaster, people who have experienced traumatic events, in McNally's estimation, tend to remember the essential and most frightening elements of that experience. So he used the example of someone who works at a convenience store and is held at gunpoint. He said, quote, "The person may often encode the features of the weapon, the gun pointed at him, but not recall whether or not the person was wearing glasses because their attention is focused on the most central features of the experience." So because Valentina was 17, I wanted to know a little bit more about teenagers and memory. And we know that teenagers' brains are still forming, but that actually helps, as you'll know, with children and teenagers. It's better for them to learn languages earlier on because they're going through this neuroplasticity where they're able to retain information more. But I found an article from The Guardian by a psychologist called Frank T. McAndrew, and it was titled "Why Are High School Memories Burnt Into Our Brains?" And I was like, oh my God, I can remember so many. I can remember the smell of our home economics room, you know, and then I can't remember much university-wise, just fragments, and then beyond that, you know. And he's an evolutionary psychologist, and he said that the reason that we remember high school so well years down the track is because, quote, "strong emotions equal strong memories," which is why, because we're raging with hormones and everything like that at the time, and we're having all these strong emotions, forming friendships, hormonal changes, you know, first love, all of that, that is encoded because it's a strong emotion creating a strong memory. Now, to tie it into this episode, I wanted to kind of link different symptoms and how they all link together. And so I looked into whether hypothermia affects memory, and of course it does. Memory recall for someone who is going through hypothermia can be something pretty intense, but they do say that usually it's a complete loss of memory or amnesia for that entire event. It's not full recall like what Valentina experienced. Now, to recap the autopsies before we get into each potential theory in this case, I wanted to say that they put it down to hypothermia primarily, but they also all showed symptoms of having a protein deficiency. Now, they don't explain to what extent. It could be a minor one. That is something that I've kept in mind. It could be something that's just systemic among the group because of how they lived back home. Maybe they didn't eat a whole lot of protein-rich foods. But the autopsy, just to recap, also said that the dead people in the group had bruised lungs. Now, again, they didn't say the extent of which their lungs were bruised. You can have a small bruise that doesn't affect anything, or you can have full-on lung bruising, which can lead to like a pulmonary edema. But hypothermia can also lead to bruised lungs as well. But remember, Ludmila died of a heart attack. That's what killed her. And I presume that happened before hypothermia fully set in. So that takes precedent as her cause of death. And all at some stage seem to be suffering from protein deficiency, which I would have found it interesting to see if Valentina, being the surviving person, was blood tested to see if she also had this, because it's a thought that I had regarding whether or not people in that area of the world that they were from dealt with a protein deficiency that was kind of chronic. Now, a bruised lung is called a pulmonary contusion. The autopsy, as I said, doesn't say how bruised, so I'm taking that kind of with a grain of salt. Small bruises in the lung may not even have symptoms. Larger ones will present symptoms. Bruised lungs are usually caused by some sort of blunt trauma, an attack, a sports injury, some sort of trauma to the chest. You get it in almost 100% of people who have been in car accidents, or, you know, been kicked by a horse, something like that. It causes bleeding or swelling in the lungs. But I also found that it was really common after World War One or Two from explosion injuries or a shockwave associated with an explosion. So almost like being near an explosion happening
actually caused a penetrating trauma, which is really interesting. They go into quite a lot of this, but I can't explain it because I'm not like scientifically minded, or especially not physics minded. According to the NIH, bruised lungs can also be caused by an inflammatory response as part of something else. Now, a step up from a bruised lung is a collapsed lung. This can be caused by, of course, all kinds of trauma. You get that a lot in car accident victims or people who have been attacked or stabbed. If it's been kind of, you know, Hugh de la Plaza had the beginning of that. But it also, I found, can be caused by high or low altitude, because I was trying to make it match with this through my reading. And I found, obviously, that a bruised or collapsed lung can be caused by scuba diving. A lot of scuba divers suffer from this, or a collapsed lung as part of, you know, just complete depressurization, but also the other end of that, mountain climbing. And I also found that tall, thin people, according to Medline, apparently are more susceptible to a collapsed lung or a bruised lung than shorter, more stocky people. Found this really interesting. I went and looked what the average height for a Kazakh is, because in 2018, the last time I went to Thailand, the Kazakh Olympic team, for some reason, were all in the airport when I was in transit in Malaysia, and I actually took a photo of them all. They're all ginormous. Now, they were clearly all the basketball players, so they're going to be tall. But I asked someone who they were, who was traveling with the group, because they were all ginormous, and they said they're the Kazakh, like, Olympic basketball team. And I looked up the Kazakh average height because I thought, these people must be huge, but they're actually not. They're actually shorter than, say, the average Australian woman is 5'4", and Kazakh people, women in general, are 5'3", and men are shorter than average as well. Now, I did not include in the first episode that when Valentina was found, she had a cold, and the sources say she was treated with antibiotics, which can't be right because a cold's viral, and antibiotics are for a bacterial infection. So they probably just meant like cold and flu medication or something like that. But that's really all she was suffering from, a cold, which kind of makes sense when she's been traipsing around for 5 days out in the wilderness and her immune system is kind of depressed. I was just wondering if the rest of them had started to suffer from colds as well. Now, keep in mind, walking around in wet clothes, I read this years ago because I was, people often say change out of wet clothes because you'll get a cold, but a cold is viral, and actually most studies say like being in wet clothes is not going to cause a cold, but it can cause like hypothermia and things like that. But I couldn't really link bruising of the lungs to a protein deficiency per se either. However, bruised lung is mentioned in an Oxford thesis that I found regarding what's called accidental hypothermia, which I believe is what happened with the screw. Symptoms can include difficulty breathing, pain, coughing, rapid heart rate, emphysema, excessive bronchial fluid, which I really was keeping in mind because when Valentina says people were throwing up blood, was it bronchial fluid with tinges of blood because the lining of the trachea has been torn, which can happen with excessive vomiting, that's happened to me before. Wheezing, bluish skin, and coughing up blood. So quite a lot of those, if you've listened to part one, you can apply to what she witnessed. So the excess fluid is all to do with gas exchange and things like that. And because bruised lung and altitude and hypothermia all mess with gas exchange that can lead to hypoxia, I believe that it was just altitude and hypothermia that caused the bruised lung. But I'll get back to bruised lung a little bit later. So I'm going to get into the different theories, going through them. Altitude, they ate something bad, bad water, a nerve agent, all of that. But I want you to keep in mind as I get into this that it may be caused by a combination of factors, like an unfortunate series of
events. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is potential altitude sickness causing this. Now, we talked about this extensively on the Everest episodes with Francis Arsentiev, but I'm going to briefly recap parts of it. Altitude really depends on the person. There's no way you can determine if someone's going to suffer from it or not. I suffer terribly from it, but I've also, since I was a kid, suffered terribly from motion sickness in cars. There's literal video footage of me vomiting off a barely like windy road when I was a kid off the side of the road. Half of my memories of growing up were asking my mom to pull over so I could throw up. And some people don't suffer from it at all. Altitude sickness kicks in around 2,000 meters or 6,000 feet. And the higher you go, the worse it's going to get. As we talked about on the Everest episodes, bringing yourself down to a better altitude is going to help you. But some people are born in a place that's got such high altitude, they're just used to it. For instance, people who live in La Paz or in Cuzco in Peru, La Paz in Bolivia, they're at such a high altitude, they're used to that low oxygen levels in their blood. But then you get tourists who arrive and are unable to start the Inca Trail because they're so sick so suddenly they have to leave. It really just depends on your overall health. If you've already got like low oxygen levels or bad circulation or you smoke or something like that, your lung capacity, obviously, it's all going to affect that. Some people, you know, can have no issues. You can get it mild to severe or moderate, and it can affect the lungs or the brain. If you remember from that episode, that's generally either what kills you, a cerebral edema or a pulmonary one. Mild symptoms include dizziness, fatigue and loss of energy, shortness of breath, loss of appetite or sleep problems. And then moderate altitude sickness, it gets all of these symptoms get worse fatigue, worse weakness, worse shortness of breath. But there's usually evidence that it's happening, that it's progressing. Coordination problems, difficulty walking, if you remember, difficulty kind of speaking from the Everest episodes, headache, nausea, vomiting, chest tightness or congestion, and difficulty doing regular activities. Although at this stage, you may be able to still walk independently. And then you get to severe altitude sickness, which can lead to death, coma, generally in death. This is severe shortness of breath, even when you're not doing anything, you're resting, the inability to walk, confusion, and you get fluid buildup in the lungs or the brain. And one of the things about this is that with altitude sickness, if you suffer from the cerebral altitude sickness, you can actually experience psychosis as a result of that. And we touched on that a little bit in the Everest episodes. And I just want you to keep in mind, remember Tatiana started smashing her head into a rock right before she seemed to have died. And a lot of these different things could cause that. I don't think she was taken over by a demon. The next theory is that it's something they consumed, whether it was the golden root that we talked about that they were picking as they walked and they were drying out and you can consume it. Now, this is not poisonous. It would take quite a lot. Every source I found said that people consume it raw or cooked. And according to WebMD, it is safe to consume in relatively large doses. It's actually widely used for mental health issues as well. I found a really interesting study that found that golden root has worked really well with schizophrenic patients, which is really interesting. The one thing it can do is that it stimulates the immune system. And if you suffer from an autoimmune disease, like what I have, or multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis, it can actually worsen that because it stimulates your immune system when you're trying to suppress your own immune system attacking itself. So they don't recommend it for people who have autoimmune conditions. So was it something that the group consumed? Was it something that was poisoned or something that had something poisonous on it? Patron Jay, I haven't heard his full theory, but he believes, like a lot of people online, suggest that there were like wild mushrooms that were toxic growing in these parts up on this mountain, and that maybe they consumed it. But what kind of makes me think that this could potentially not really be the case is that I do think Ludmilla was quite an intelligent woman. She'd done this a lot, and as a hiker, she really knew what was good to eat and what wasn't. And I feel like she would have educated her students on this kind of thing. And you would have to consume quite a substantial amount of something like golden root for it to have a mass effect, but also would the mass effect cause this domino effect where everyone started dropping immediately? Maybe that's one of the interesting things, you know, if they consumed something dodgy early that morning and it all started happening to them. Now, I can't get a firm read on whether or not Valentina had consumed any of this, and that would kind of be interesting. But the autopsy does not discuss gastric contents like it's anything immediately. You would think, even if it was a corrupt autopsy tech, that they would include that, that they would say these people ate these things that were poisonous, you know, like Chris McCandless did and died out in the wild. You'd think they'd put that down because autopsies check gastric contents and toxicology and all that, but it doesn't mention that. So I'm kind of the assumption that that's just not the case. The next theory is something simple like bad water. Now, I don't think at this stage they were near running water. I believe they were carrying most of their water and they'd only been out for a couple of days. Remember that Valentina had to walk ages to get to running water? But say they came across a stream or something, you would think again that Ludmilla would know to at least boil it. Now, boiling water doesn't get rid of chemicals and things in it, but it does get rid of like bacteria. So you want to boil your water out in the wild. Maybe something bacterial that was in water, not agreeing with them, or a chemical in the water that had come downstream from some sort of Russian testing station. That was another thought I had. But this is all something to keep in mind. But again, the autopsies do not mention any kind of bacteria that you would think would show up in an autopsy regarding like dirty water. The next theory that people, because it's, I guess, Russia, especially at the time, they tend to come back to is like a nerve agent. And we talked extensively about nerve agents on the Alexei Navalny episode because he was poisoned by Novichok and barely, you know, clung to life, and you know, we all know what happened with that. First of all, it was a little bit different, and I think it's more likely in the Dyatlov Pass incident that this could have played a part, not only because people saw weird like orbs in the sky and witnessed strange things, but that was known to kind of be in the vicinity of a testing site. This is not. When you look at pictures of it, it is completely like open, barren. There's no seeming nuclear testing sites up there. But then I thought, well, you know, it was rainy and snowing and it was a rainstorm. It could have been chemicals carried in by the wind. But then I reminded myself, well, why not Valentina? You know, if everyone's going to succumb to this, why not her? And why not the other two groups that were also on the mountain at the time? It didn't happen to them. I don't believe there was someone up there trying to kill them and following their group around. But nerve agent symptoms are quite interesting, but they also can be confused, you know, with hypothermia or altitude sickness and things that Valentina witnessed. According to the CDC, quote, inhalation of a nerve agent or pesticide leads to a quicker onset of poisoning with more severe symptoms when compared to dermal exposure given the same amount of agent. Now, if you remember in the Navalny episode, they soaked his underwear in Novichok. He then put them on while he was touring around campaigning. And he was already on the plane when he started to feel sick. And this ties in with that dermal exposure, like with Alexei Navalny, it takes a while to soak into your skin, whereas immediate kind of inhalation is going to bring on immediate effects. So you would assume with this group, the way that it's happening would be some sort of inhalation. So I found a list of kind of symptoms of toxic syndrome caused by a nerve agent from the CDC. And I found it really interesting because it affects central nervous system, respiration, cardiovascular, everything. So central nervous system symptoms include meiosis, either one eye or two. So that's kind of pinprick pupils, constriction of pupils, headache, restlessness, convulsions, loss of consciousness and coma, respiratory symptoms. And this is taking into account all nerve agents. It's a general overview for emergency use by the CDC. But the thing is, if someone comes into a hospital, the symptoms are so broad, it would take a while to narrow it down, which I think is what happened with that guy who was poisoned and he ended up dying in the London hospital. They're so broad, you could apply them to so many different illnesses. Respiratory symptoms include a watery or runny nose, bronchial secretions that are excessive, wheezing, dyspnea, which is shortness of breath, chest tightness, increased respiration, or decreased respiration. Cardiovascular symptoms include tachycardia, which is a high heart rate, hypertension, high blood pressure. Also bradycardia, which is low heart rate, hypotension, which is low blood pressure, or some sort of cardiac arrhythmia. Gastrointestinal symptoms of nerve agent can be abdominal pain, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, urinary incontinence. Then there's musculoskeletal signs and symptoms, including weakness of your muscles. And then there's skin and mucous membrane signs and symptoms, such as profuse sweating, excessive kind of tears forming in your eyes, and infections of the conjunctiva, like conjunctivitis. So that's all really interesting, but they're all very kind of general. The next theory is mass psychosis, which I'm really not going to get into too much. I mean, it's up for debate, I suppose. I just really, my gut really pushes back against this. Ludmila is not just suddenly, as an experienced person who probably knew first aid and she probably knew CPR and she's a hiker, she's a mother, she's not just going to spin out and have a massive heart attack from shock at seeing what was happening to Sasha and then everybody else starting doing that. It's not just going to click in when you read about different events that people put down to mass psychosis. It's not just like one after the other after the other. I would be more inclined to think it was a nerve agent over mass psychosis in this instance, because again, what makes Valentina different? The next theory, which is actually what it was put down to that ultimately killed all of them, was hypothermia. And we discussed hypothermia, obviously, at length in the Everest episodes, along with altitude. And often the two happen simultaneously. And hypothermia is extremely dangerous. You can, as they call it, accidental hypothermia. You can be dying of it without even realizing it's happening. Now, if a person progresses into severe hypothermia, they usually go from initially shivering as a manifestation of hypothermia to stopping shivering. The shivering stops as they progress. And I don't, as much as I do believe they suffered from hypothermia on this trip, because Valentina has spoken so little about this, I don't know if they were all sitting there the whole night before all shivering. I presume people were. They'd been walking around wet all day with no way to warm up. No, they weren't changing. They didn't, if you remember, that search and rescue guy said, you know, all their packs were packed and it didn't seem like the night before they'd tried to stay alive. But then after I said that, I thought, well, that's an interesting thing for him to say, because search and rescue didn't find their bodies for 2 weeks. Don't you think their packs would have dried by then? So how do you know, unless there's just no way for them to dry once they're wrapped up in these plastic tarps? So if a person progresses into severe, not only does shivering stop, but exhaustion sets in and their skin can be very cool and pale. This is not for everybody. Some people can seem, they can be flushed. Everybody is different biologically. If you remember, Frances Arsentiev was like a wax mannequin almost. That's why they called her the Sleeping Beauty of Everest. They said she looked like a mannequin. As hypothermia advances, people start to be able, like, they're not able to walk properly. They're kind of unsteady. They're fumbling a lot. They start having slurred speech. We don't hear any of that in Valentina's recollections. It all seems to happen very quickly, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't happening. Just everybody is different. They experience a dramatic drop in body temperature where they're not able to warm themselves up enough. And when in the depths of hypothermia, people can display bizarre characteristics, which we talked about on the Everest episodes. Two of these are called terminal burrowing and paradoxical undressing. Now, to recap, paradoxical undressing is a phenomena that happens when somebody is in the throes of severe hypothermia. According to Live Science, quote, to shut down the loss of heat from the extremities, the body induces vasoconstriction, the reflexive contraction of blood vessels. Over time, however, the muscles necessary for inducing vasoconstriction become exhausted and fail, causing warm blood to rush from the core to the extremities. This results in a kind of hot flash that makes victims of severe hypothermia, who are already confused and disoriented, feel as if they're burning up. So they remove their clothes, researchers have concluded. And you get this, you see this a lot in the Everest cases. It's one of the most common ones. But you also remember from Valentina's recollections, the two teenagers were like pulling their clothes off, you know, and clutching at their necks. Now, the next one is called terminal burrowing. It actually makes me very sad because it's kind of like this very primitive response from a human being to kind of protect themselves. And this is the final stages of hypothermia. It's really sad. And PubMed had an article on this by M.A. Rothschild in 1995. And usually terminal burrowing happens after paradoxical undressing. Quote, nearly all bodies with partial or complete disrobement were found in a position which indicated a final mechanism of protection, i.e. under a bed, behind a wardrobe, in a shelf, etc. This is obviously an autonomous process of the brainstem, which is triggered in the final state of hypothermia and produces a primitive and burrowing type behavior of protection, as seen in hibernating animals. This phenomena, which we refer to as terminal burrowing behavior, occurred predominantly with slow decreases in temperature and moderately cold conditions. Unquote. Now, this is also called hide or die, they call it. And in the final stages, you try to move behind something or burrow into something, which you get in the Dyatlov Pass case. They tried to burrow under the snow. In this one, the way I can apply it is, do you remember Valentina tried to hide behind a rock when she hit the ground? And then later Dennis did as well, just suddenly went and hid behind a rock. I think that that was in a manifestation of terminal burrowing. And there's something about it that just makes me really sad. It's like this last-ditch attempt to preserve yourself. And I found something fascinating in a number of medical studies, which I really started to apply to this, and I'm glad that I found it. Now, a number of studies into hypothermia, because I was looking into seizures and how they work with hypothermia and everything that was going on here. And a number of studies have described late or rebound seizures during rewarming after 72 hours of hypothermia. And when I saw that, I was like, boom, that's what I was looking for. These people had been freezing for like, you know, all day the day before, all night, and then they'd gotten up and they'd gotten going. And according to Valentina's recollections, it was within minutes of leaving their camp, packing up and moving again, that all this started happening. And I thought that was really interesting when I first read about it. And so I was trying to tie in what precipitated this event, and it was this sudden movement. So when I found that these studies have actually described late or rebound seizures as a result of rewarming after hypothermia, when you're suddenly moving again, your body's warming itself, you start seizing. I thought that's fascinating, and that's honestly what I believe happened with a number of them. It was that sudden moving again, body starting to warm up after such a long time of being in hypothermia and maybe not even realizing it. And then boom, like your brain just can't handle that sudden change. Also, I found something interesting that not only does golden root help with mental illnesses, but hypothermia treatment has been used in the treatment of schizophrenia and has had really good outcomes. A lot of people are really into like cold plunges and stuff now, which I've talked about before. Just be really wary of that, because if you've got like pre-existing heart conditions or issues with your body, cold narcosis, like as they put it, or hypothermia, like almost inducing sudden cold plunges, can actually, you know, stop your heart, especially if you've got a pacemaker and stuff. So the people selling these products like are not doctors, and I see cold plunge pools, and I was reading like a thread the other day because it came up as an ad for me saying, you know, buy this cold plunge pool. And they were like giving medical advice in the comments to people inquiring about the product. And I was really concerned about that. Like, you know, you're trying to sell a product that I don't think you fully understand what you're saying. Like they were saying, get it down to 2 degrees Celsius or whatever. And at no point did they mention, you know, if you've got a heart condition or anything like that. And I was like, this is why brands, and this is an issue that I face constantly working in marketing, this is why brands have become too ballsy with the claims that they're making. And now they've been hit with legalities surrounding, okay, I can't say it, this does this anymore. We have to say this may do this now. You know, like I've had to tell brands, you know, legally you can't say this does this. You have to say it may, like legally in Australia. And they're like, oh, I didn't know that. And it's like, okay, well, you're going to end up fucking sued at some point. Hypothermia can also induce heart attacks. Obviously, by the way, it's usually like the last phase, and it can induce lung bruising. Now, on the first episode, I talked about this expert who interviewed Valentina, and then he went and recreated the trek and everything that happened, and only 5 years to the day after it. And he walked away with a theory, and I left you hanging with that one. Vladimir Zarov, the man who did that, he walked away believing that it was what the autopsy said, that it was hypothermia. From what he witnessed, what he put together over 5 years of research, and I'm inclined to believe him because he actually didn't have really skin in the game. So then I wanted to touch on this protein deficiency that it said that they all suffered from within their autopsies. And again, the autopsies didn't state the extent. You can suffer from it in a minor way, or you can have kind of late stage protein deficiency that ultimately kills you. They didn't say this was the clincher of this whole case. It was actually hypothermia, but that they all suffered to it from an extent, which made me think that it was something systemic that was happening maybe in their upbringings, that they didn't have a protein-rich diet. By the way, after I talked about protein in the first episode, I had a 100% protein meal, and I was thinking about it the whole time. No chance of that with Felicity, because I barely consumed protein for a long time. I didn't eat meat for about 6 years at one point. It made me feel terrible, all in all. I lost a lot of weight. But I had a lot of medical situations, and Graves' disease came off the bat of that. I'm not saying it caused it or anything. But since then, I've found massive relief in protein-rich diets, which a lot of people are now on board with. Working with a functional doctor has changed things dramatically for me, as opposed to the zero education I've received through my actual specialists. I've learned so much about my condition and how diet and supplements and everything works with my condition, how it lowers inflammation, about, you know, oxidative stress, about gut inflammation causing a lot of autoimmunity. So I'm pretty passionate kind of about this and how people aren't getting enough protein because they've been told for years, which even major medical associations now are turning the tables on that. They've been told, you know, this is bad. It'll cause high cholesterol. Well, yeah, it does in like huge amounts. I've suffered from high cholesterol genetically my whole life, even when I was a stick thin. My grandfather always said he passed it on to everyone because everyone has it, no matter if they don't eat high protein eggs, all of that. I've had to be on medication for it on and off my whole life. But it's just really turned the tables on what people think. And I've seen a lot of people now turning towards high protein stuff and seeing massive results reversing the severity of autoimmunity. And I suggest looking into it, but because I say people can't just give medical advice when they don't know anything about it, I'm pretty passionate on that. Always look up what's right for you. But I wanted to talk about protein deficiency. So on the last episode, I was doing it off memory and I couldn't remember what the name of late stage protein deficiency is, where often it's represented in the starving children in Africa with their big swollen tummies. And I found it's called kwashiorkor. It's a really strange word. And this is generally applied across the board for all ages who end up with this, but the term is marasmus in childhood protein deficiency. And this isn't just deficiency, it's malnutrition, a severe protein calorie malnutrition. Now, both of these conditions result from a diet almost entirely deficient of protein calories, but also people can suffer from this if they have chronic infections in their bodies that can be caused by all kinds of things. Now, the opposite of protein malnutrition is called protein toxicity. When I was reading about that, I realized that a lot of people are into these protein shakes. Again, these companies never tell you what they can cause in some people, which is why you should always do your own research and don't just take people who want to make money off you on face value. These protein shakes and protein supplements, a woman died in Australia and it's been in the courts from protein toxicity from those products, despite the fact she wasn't taking a whole amount, a huge amount. There was just too much. It was too dense with protein that she ended up with protein toxicity, which killed her. But with protein deficiency, you end up with like whole body malnutrition, complete muscle wastage, fatigue, loss of appetite, bloating, diarrhea. In children, it forms a failure to thrive. They're often quite small. Massive weight loss, often swelling in the extremities, apathy, hair loss, irritability, skin rash. It's often very evident that you're suffering from late stage, which makes me think that this group weren't, that it was just something that was a simmering issue, but not a major one in them, which makes me think that these people didn't consume enough protein as part of their everyday diets back in Kazakhstan. And I don't know if Kazakhstanis have low protein diets generally. I actually know that the highest rate of vegetarians in the world is Bangladesh. It's like 80% of people are vegetarians and they've often got low protein, low iron. I'm not sure about the availability at the time these people were growing up for protein-rich foods, because when I lived in Cambodia, kids have massive, there's not enough fresh milk available, and a lot of the beef is gross and not good quality, and a lot of the kids suffer from protein malnutrition in Cambodia. So that's something to keep in mind. But generally the buildup is you lose a lot of muscle mass, which I kept in mind with this group, because this was, you can see that in photos, they're a fit, healthy, tall group of people that look super healthy. And if they were suffering from an extreme protein deficiency, that would be pretty evident. They wouldn't be climbing mountains. They would be like, you end up skeletal with swollen stomachs. And these people just didn't have that, which is another reason why I think that it was just something that they were suffering from chronically. And that's will lead into something later that I want to talk about. It also cuts into your strength. So you're not likely to be hiking mountains and things. Most people can barely keep their balance when they've got severe protein. And it slows your metabolism down. And that's why I just think the autopsy picked up on it in blood tests, obviously, and it marked it down. And then I think over time, people have picked up that and put it down. Oh, this could be it, you know, when it was just a contributing factor, but it wasn't the be-all and end-all. It also can ultimately lead to anemia as well, and your cells just don't get enough oxygen and you're tired all the time. Now, reading about protein deaths, you'd be really surprised by how many people still die from this every year across the world. According to our World in Data, numbers have dropped off dramatically for protein malnutrition and death in the last 30 years. For instance, in 1990, deaths worldwide from protein energy malnutrition was in the millions. And flash forward just 2019, it's been dramatically lowered, but it still feels like a huge amount because so many people are starving across the world and not getting everything that they need into their diet. So 2019, the last numbers available was 212,000 people across the world died of protein energy malnutrition. And yeah, you never hear about that from the news, do you? Huge numbers on the 0 to 5 bracket when they're formative years, children, if they suffer from it early, they're likely to die, and the 70 plus age group, so elderly people. Obviously, this happens with most illnesses. It's you know, teenagers and young adults are more likely to survive something, but the very young and the very old aren't. Malnutrition is also a linked medical disorder to hypothermia. It can, you know, be a contributing factor of you being a sufferer of hypothermia, and also hypoglycemia, which is low blood sugar. So maybe they all had it and it was chronic, as in they lived a low protein life and it's just a coincidence. But what I found interesting when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about it last night. If you're going to say that they all had protein deficiency, how does that explain the guys who survived the plane crash in the Andes coming out without a protein deficiency after 73 days? You know, granted, they were eating the dead people around them. But I've read Alive. I've read it a number of times, and you have to if you haven't read it. Yes, you can watch the movie, but Ethan Hawke playing Uruguayan was kind of strange. And it's one of my favorite stories of all time. I think of these guys all the time. It just passed the 50th anniversary. Most of them are still alive. They weren't feasting on massive cuts of meat from their friends. I can't believe I'm saying that. But when you read it, they had kind of little bags of it, and they ran out of it eventually. They'd used up everything from everybody they could. Sorry to put it like that, but it's the truth. And the book is very detailed talking about that. So the guys that hiked out, Nando and Roberto, ultimately, and got help, and they're just amazing when you read their stories. They didn't suffer from, they were at a high altitude. They were not just protein deficient, complete calorie deficient. They'd used up all of their resources, and they only had this tiny bag that they'd made out of clothing, which had a few strips of human meat in it. And they hiked for 11 days after, 60 something days. They decided, we've got to do it, the two of us, because we'll all die. The 16 of us left of, 60. And they managed to do it. And they didn't have protein deficiency, and they didn't have altitude sickness. They'd kind of acclimated, and none of this stuff happened, and they'd been up there for 73 days in, the Andes Mountains. And how did Yossi Ginsberg survive for 17 days hiking with no calories at all in the Bolivian jungle? I guess it just comes down to kind of people's makeup, but I'm just not inclined to think that after 2 days hiking, some sort of chronic protein deficiency is going to get you. I don't even think it was a contributing factor in any of these deaths. I think it was just something that showed up on blood tests. I want to talk about what I think happened, but also a couple of thoughts I had that were, I think, unique. I haven't seen people come up with these, but it was just something to do with proximity that made me think, and I went off and researched about it. So while I think hypothermia was the pretty much defining factor, I think it was just a combination of factors as well that these people died of that unfortunately presented themselves as something out of a horror movie, because Valentina was witnessing it happening. And I also believe that her memory, while correct, has rammed together events that could have happened an hour apart or 2 hours apart in terms of episodic memory. While I do think hypothermia had set in dramatically, because they had not seemed to try to stay warm at all the night before, it seems that they were all just sitting around all night shivering and not making any attempt to keep warm, which makes me think that Ludmilla, being their leader, was really suffering from late stage hypothermia at this stage, and it had really set in to do with how high up they were, how wet they were, just a combination of factors. Why not Valentina? Well, like with the guys who survived the Andes Mountain crash, like with Yossi Ginsberg, it's just the luck of the draw, to use a term my mum uses for literally everything. It's just capacity for survival. It's like Viktor Frankl talked about people in Auschwitz, the ones that lasted the longest. He saw commonalities in their personalities, but often it was just luck. And with this, maybe it's just genetics. It's the guys in the Andes Mountains had their bodies on their side. They were tough footballers, and a lot of experts believe that that worked to their advantage. But a lot of the seemingly toughest footballers succumb to altitude starvation very quickly, whereas the ones like Nando, who hiked his way out, who Ethan Hawke plays for some reason, he was actually the least likely they would think to survive. But he actually had meaning, which is a whole other thing that I've thought a lot about in regards to Viktor Frankl. He hiked his way out when the odds were against him, because he had to get to his dad and tell him, "I'm alive," because his mum and his sister had died in the plane crash, the initial impact. And he recollects it like, if I died, Dad would never know what happened to all of us. I have to get back to him. And that 11-day hike at the tail end of the trip, when they'd been in the fuselage freezing and experiencing avalanche and starvation and cannibalism,
for 60 something days. When him and Roberto hiked out for 11 days, he said his dad's image was in his mind the whole entire time. Now, Roberto's a different story. They actually just picked him because he was a bit of a nutter, like he didn't get along with anyone, super egotistical, would do things just to spite people. And they said, take Roberto because he'll do it just purely out of ego. Like he won't allow himself to fail. And in the last kind of days, when they were hiking out before every peak they reached and they'd look down and it would be glaciers, and every peak Nando would be rallying Roberto, there would be the green grass of Chile on the other side, and it wasn't. And it ended up being an 11-day hike at the end of it. And Roberto was on his hands and knees, literally with diarrhea, like just crawling, pooing his pants. That's like late stage starvation, hypothermia and altitude all combined. It's a nightmare when you read the book. But that didn't happen to Nando. He didn't have all of that. It's actually funny that when you're in late stage starvation, you actually suffer from diarrhea a lot. And it's a really strange thing because you'd think your body would be trying to retain things, but it's just not. Yossi Ginsberg walked out without seemingly, you know, any roll-on effects. There's so many instances of people surviving, the capacity for survival based on like a complete mystery. We just don't know. So that brings me to the unique thought that I had. Now, when I first picked up this case and I thought, Russia, 1993, the first thing I thought was, how close is this to the Chernobyl nuclear disaster? This is 6 years after, or 7 years, Chernobyl. The explosion happened in 1986. It had a serious impact on millions of people. Radiation was just detected as far as England. It drifted that far. So, of course, it's going to affect people in Kazakhstan, being the fact that it happened in what is now today Ukraine. They didn't do anything about it until radiation was detected in Sweden. People today still suffer from it. The fallout of that and the effects, gene mutations and all kinds of physical effects, huge amounts of autoimmunity in that part of the world. Now, I was just thinking, were these people predisposed because of the environment that they grew up in? Because I knew that there was a lot of nuclear testing, not just with Chernobyl and the explosion, but deliberate nuclear testing in these areas. So I looked it up, and from, you know, Chernobyl, Pripyat, where it happened, to where these people were from in Kazakhstan, it's 3,000 kilometers or a 43-hour drive away. It's really not that far when you think about it. Now, I decided to research Kazakhstan and nuclear fallout to see kind of if there was any major spikes. And of course there was. And a lot of it happened around the time that these people were either children or their parents were about to have them. So I was kind of thinking, does that affect your protein intake or how you're able to kind of, did your body break down protein and things like that? Kazakhs were majorly affected by not only the radiation spread of Chernobyl, but also nuclear testing that had gone on for decades in Kazakhstan. In fact, when Chernobyl happened, they sent Kazakhs to clean up the reactor. So a huge amount of the initial ones that died within days of going and doing that, that they called soldiers at the time, were Kazakhs. Kazakhstan did extensive nuclear testing throughout the Cold War. According to History Today, the Soviets selected a site called Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan as a major testing site. They settled on this, which is in the northeastern part of Kazakhstan. And the people who lived in the surrounding areas had absolutely no say. They were either told to fuck off or to keep their traps shut and to get on with it. Which, you know, always happens. They did nuclear testing in the United States and people were told the same thing. These inhabitants, according to History Today, became human guinea pigs in a disastrous atomic experiment as the blasts hurled radioactive fallout over northern, eastern and central Kazakhstan and Russian Siberia, exposing hundreds of thousands of people at a minimum to toxic radiation. A research centre, innocuously named Anti-Brucellos Dispensary No. 4, which ostensibly studied an infectious disease found in cattle, actually existed to research how radiation affected the human body. Your government cares about you guys, don't worry. So this site, this major site,
actually was in existence for decades and actually only closed in 1991, 2 years before this incident. So these people in Kazakhstan have their whole lives, pretty much everyone in this group had grown up with this in existence, and it was only 1,000 kilometers from the town of Petropavlovsk, Kazakhstan, that they grew up in. Now, almost 3 decades after this closed, they're still studying the full impact of the blasts on human health, albeit probably they don't really care that much, and also on the environment around them and how much of it is soaked into soil and water. And, you know, it's kind of like that East Palestine. It's like, oh, whatever, like you'll be fine. And then everyone in that town will have cancer in 10 years. I hate to say that, but listen to the locals, what they're saying. So they've taken no responsibility for doing any of this, and they've seen massive cancer spikes in people who lived in this region, as well as other diseases and disorders, especially autoimmune conditions. Now, I was familiar with this, which I'll talk about in a minute, as part of my own personal research. So studies also suggest that victims of nuclear testing in Kazakhstan in particular suffer from severe PTSD as a result of this. Now, the symptoms of radiation poisoning are vast, but they depends on how much you're consuming. Obviously, the ones who went straight to the reactor to clean it out and weren't told exactly what was happening died within days. But if you're poisoned long term, you can loss of appetite, fatigue, fever, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, possibly even seizures and coma after prolonged exposure. So this is where kind of what I already knew came into play. So I knew that after Chernobyl, the government handed out, especially in Ukraine, what is today Ukraine, what's called Lugol's iodide to locals in order to stop their thyroid absorbing the radiation. And when there's a radioactive fallout or something, this is one of the first things that governments do. Now, the reason that I know this is because I've taken it before, because I took it pre my thyroidectomy, because you have to for surgery and you have to take it for 2 weeks before. So essentially the thyroid absorbs radiation. And after Chernobyl, there were, and today, through essentially it's a gene mutation that has fucked people over for generations, like what happens with Agent Orange in Vietnam, there is huge numbers of thyroid cancer and hyperthyroidism or Graves' disease, which is what I suffer from, reported across Eastern Europe, huge numbers, especially in Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Russia. Now, when I was diagnosed with Graves' disease, the first thing that any specialist you see asks you is, did you grow up near a nuclear radiation site? Now, no, I didn't. And maybe I was adopted from, fucking Ukraine and my parents just haven't told me, but I doubt that's true. So in my case, it's probably just a genetic condition where environment, they say, genetics loads the gun and environment pulls the trigger. But thyroid cancer, if you look up pictures and look up research of this, it's huge in that part of the world because so many people's thyroids were absorbing this radiation fallout and often they were never handed Lugol's iodide. Now, Lugol's iodide is available in pill or liquid form. When you have a thyroidectomy, they give it to you in liquid form and you put 3 drops 3 times a day in. I tried it by itself. It's like drinking evil. That's how I explain it to people. It's like poison. You can put it in juice or water, and I had to do it 3 times a day for 2 weeks. And by the end of it, I had such a response to even the prospect of doing it. I felt like I was drinking poison, that the final one before my surgery that I had to swallow, I could barely get it down. So Lugol's blocks the absorption of radiation into the thyroid. And they handed it out post Chernobyl in excess. Now, when I was diagnosed, you have to have a nuclear scan to show the Graves' disease. And they inject you, you have a nuclear scan and they inject you with, this is really like complicated and sometimes they like stuff it up, but they inject you with this stuff that's essentially like iodine. And then 15 minutes later, they scan you. Because you're, they inject you with what is essentially like radiation almost. And it's also a way to kill the thyroid as well, which is a whole other thing. And they wait 15 minutes and then they do a kind of like an MRI scan of your neck. And usually the thyroid absorbs it and then it leaves. And so you shouldn't really be able to see the thyroid on a normal thyroid on the scan by this stage. It's already gone in and exited. But in Graves, it holds on to it all. So my scans, it's like this giant neck goiter that's like black after 15 minutes. It absorbs it and it holds on to it. And that's how one of the determining factors when they diagnose you. But Lugol's iodide, the reason that they give it to you before a thyroidectomy is because they have to do it legally. It decreases vascularity in your neck and blood flow to the thyroid. It also dramatically lowers your thyroid levels, which are really high in hyperthyroidism. You can only do it short term. It's not safe to do it for any more than 2 weeks. I believe once a year, my endocrinologist told me. So they have to do the surgery once you start it, which is a whole other thing I could talk about. And it essentially lowers the risk of you bleeding out during surgery, because there is such a high risk of that during a thyroidectomy, and it's still quite a dangerous procedure. So you drink that, and luckily for me, it dramatically lowered my thyroid levels enough to make it stable enough to remove it, and it also dramatically lowered the vascularity of that area, so it did the trick. Now, the reason that they handed it out post-Chernobyl was so that people, their thyroids, because the governments knew, they knew what it was going to do, because they started handing out Lugol's iodide, which is also called potassium iodide, en masse around, you know, 1,000 kilometer radius of Chernobyl. And it was to stop the thyroid from absorbing the radiation, because they fucking knew that decades later there'd be huge amounts of thyroid cancer. And, you know, because the thyroid is the only gland of the body that absorbs radiation en masse. So I'm not saying all of this nuclear testing caused this event, but when I saw where they were from and the year, and it just really made me think, you know, this Cold War fallout of nuclear testing with people. And radiation weakens your immune system, but so does kind of low-lying, non-detectable autoimmunity in people, which causes chronic inflammation in people's bodies, maybe without them even knowing it, making them susceptible to other infections and conditions. And then you add on top of that diet, altitude, hypothermia. I started to think maybe these people were just genetically programmed for something terrible to happen to them without even realizing it. So this was the entire childhoods of these people, and most of Ludmilla's childhoods as well. And maybe they had chronic body-wide inflammation, which caused an inability to process protein. And I actually found like an autoimmune condition that is really common in this part of the world, and it had a really confusing name, where your liver has difficulty processing proteins. And I didn't really include the research into it, but I just, everything kind of started to come together for me, and I just thought it was really interesting. But regardless of whether or not it was caused by like a nuclear fallout or something, I believe that this was just an unfortunate snowball effect where they were all frozen and probably in hypothermia all day and all night, the previous day and night, slipping into it without even realizing it. It can develop in as little as 5 minutes in temperatures of minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit if you're not dressed properly or you have exposed skin. They really weren't dressed for the kind of weather that they encountered. It can even just come from being in rain constantly, from being sweaty for a long period of time, or for submersion in cold water. So once they started walking, I believe this sudden rise in temperature to stay warm caused those seizures, as I talked about the studies that say that it's a rebound seizure as a result of rewarming after hypothermia. Seizures can cause nosebleeds, which happened during this event, and it can cause spontaneous ear bleeds as well. I found an entire forum on this online of people who suffer from epilepsy, and right before they have the fit, they all were saying, my nose starts bleeding and I get like blood coming out of my ears, which is terrible. So once Sasha fell, Ludmilla runs to help, and maybe the sudden rush of adrenaline in a weakened state caused a fatal heart attack, and her eyes and nose were pouring blood, you know, which can also be a result of hypothermia or altitude, and she's having a seizure. Then the oldest of the group, Tatiana, who was 24, she runs to render assistance, but she's already, this sudden rewarming causes this seizure. She's grabbing at her throat. She can't breathe. She falls to the ground. I believe this was the terminal burrowing, where she crawls to the nearby rock and then she starts smashing her head into the rock. And there's huge amounts of studies into psychosis caused by hypothermia, terminal burrowing psychosis, which unfortunately for Tatiana, I think is what happened to her. So then the two teenagers collapse while running and they die in a similar manner, throwing up blood, clawing at their throats, and obviously dealing with paradoxical undressing because they were tearing their clothes off. Three of the six victims were found minus shoes and, you know, elements of clothing you'd think they'd need. And then realizing that they were the only ones left, Valentina and Dennis are running away, and Dennis collapses convulsing, which I believe he was dealing with a combination of all of these factors as well. And I just can't tell you why Valentina survived. She couldn't have possibly understood what she was witnessing at 17 or even at any age, which is so sad. If it happened to me now, I don't even know what I'd think was happening. On the outset to her, she said it looked like a mass psychosis event, but I think biologically it was a ticking time bomb, and unfortunate. And I don't put the blame on Ludmilla. I think it was just a combination of factors. So that's what I think, and I'm interested to know what you guys think about this. Unfortunately, Kelly requested something supernatural, and for me it just didn't end up being supernatural. But then again, I don't think Bermuda Triangle is supernatural either. So, yeah, I'm really interested to know what you guys think. If you're listening on Spotify, I've got a pretty extensive poll for you to fill out, with a number of different choices. So just choose the one that you think is most likely the contributing factor. Now I'm going to vote hypothermia, the major factor. And there's a number of different ones. You can only choose one. So what you think is the major one. Now I'm going to get into world headlines, and a number of these are really important, and it's going to be a bit lengthy, but I've been thinking about it so much, and I need you guys to do a couple of things for me. All right, so the first one that I saw it about a week ago, the 11th of April, they still haven't got any suspects, but I keep checking back because this got one tiny story in the Daily Mail about 25 articles down, nothing across the Western world really, because, you know, you just don't get that, barely anything outside of Ecuador, and this is a massive case in Ecuador at the moment. Three young women aged 19, 21 and 22 are found dead with their throats slit in a shallow grave after being tortured in triple murder that has shocked Ecuador. Now, these young women, they still have not caught, they believe, two men that did it. They have the car on CCTV, but they, for some reason, haven't ruled it out. Since I did the only episode I've done in Ecuador on Maria and Marina's deaths, two young girls who were killed in Ecuador a few years ago. I did that episode, I believe, in 2020. Ecuador has experienced a sharp rise in crime, and particularly violent crime like murder. Now, these three young girls, beautiful young women, they were going to the beach on, I believe, the 4th of April. It was a couple of weeks ago, and they did not arrive and they did not come home. And then their bodies were found by fishermen in kind of an area that I looked it up on a map, and from their little beach town, they're not from Quito, they're from outside of Quito. It was a straight highway to the beach, probably like 20 minutes. Now, when you look up where they were found, it's essentially the turnoff from their town onto this main highway. Clearly someone picked them up there, and then they've driven off like a side road because they were found in an area that's kind of very swampy and stuff, and there were fishermen there. And their dog was sniffing around an area, and they smelled a really foul stench. And the photos are blurred out, but essentially they've got photos of them digging up these bodies, and the girls had been gagged and their throats cut. And they've got CCTV, I believe, of them getting into a car willingly with two men, and it seems to be a rental car. Now, I can't find anything outside of Ecuador in newspapers, so I have to like Google Translate them. The most recent one was yesterday, and it said that it was hard because I was trying to translate it, and I don't think it was right, but it said they know what kind of car it was, whereas I don't think they have the number plate. But I feel like this was just trusting the wrong people who were just terrible. And I'll keep an eye on that because, I mean, the rest of the world isn't. If this happened anywhere else, you know, three young girls, you know, 19, 21, 22, one of them's quite like a well-known singer in Ecuador, this would be on the news 24/7. Just like Marie and Maria and Marina got no attention for their murders, except in Ecuador, where people actually like have protests and femicide protests, and the protests are never even covered, you know. And we need to start, you know, looking outside the major countries, you know, Australia, United States, the United Kingdom, you know, maybe France. And we need to start kind of using the power of the media to focus on places that need that power, because when you put in Ecuador girl murders, you get like nothing. And Ecuador doesn't have a massive media circuit. So if you see information about this case, you know, share it, read about it, because, you know, they deserve it. But now that I've said that, there will be two Australian cases coming up, but it is really important, like both of them, at least to me, and to Australians. The next case is really important to me as a Melburnian, as we are known, and it's something that worries me, that I've lost sleep over, and that a lot of women in Melbourne are worried about. I talked at the start of the Toy Accordingly case about murders of women in Australia and how our justice system, parole board, you know, it's a joke. We don't have hefty sentences. I feel strongly about it. I'm not even going to talk about the laws my state tried to bring in a few years ago where families of victims of crime were not publicly allowed to speak about them, not even just telling stories about them, because it might offend the rapists and murderers. Now, this was shut down. It didn't go through because our government is incredibly evil and corrupt, and the people, thankfully, are not, and there was enough pushback. Now, because the parole board lets people out and then they just reoffend here, and then they kind of get a bit of public pressure, why'd you do that? They don't apologise and go, oh, well, we made a mistake, and then time goes on. We're about to experience that with one of the most notorious serial killers of all time, who could be out in this coming week in Melbourne, Paul Denyer. Paul Denyer is commonly known as the Frankston serial killer or the Frankston murderer. In 1993, around the time actually that this was happening in Russia with this group, over our winter, which is June, July, August, over 7 weeks, he killed three young women in the southeastern suburbs that surround a suburb called Frankston, which is still quite rough. Growing up, we called it Frankganistan, if that gives you an idea. Paul Denyer, journalists have really thankfully broken ranks of objectivity and just been really vocal about this guy cannot be up for parole. He cannot get out. One of them I saw referred to him as an oafish loser, which I wrote down because I thought that's the perfect way to put it. He is a dumb, low IQ, fat asshole. And he's been in prison for 30 years for killing three women. And that's enough for the parole board. He got 30 years, he's done it. And they're like, all right, we'll see. We'll see what he's doing. And we'll see if we'll let him out, despite the fact that for 30 years in prison, he has done nothing. They get free courses, free medical, free dental. It's pretty cruisy, prisons here. Free university courses when the rest of us have to pay. Free TAFE courses, which is technical school. One of the guards who was unfortunately tasked with caring for Paul Denyer while he was in prison said, I've got a quote from him. He said, I do think he'll kill again. I've seen quite a lot of prisoners do jail well, things like TAFE courses and university courses. Denyer hasn't done anything in 30 years. Well, he's done a few things, but I'm not even going to get into them because he's just been an attention seeker in prison for 30 years. Now, the three young women, I want you to sign a petition. And the reason that I'm talking about this is because maybe the stories of at least one of these young women will trigger you to just pause this and Google Paul Denyer petition, because it's an older petition, 2 years. People have been trying to stop this. We're now at the tail end of it. And people are kind of signing it every minute at the moment. And I need you to sign it. If you care about me and women in Melbourne, where he will be, because he will get out and he will reoffend. Paul Denyer grew up as a fucking oafish loser in the suburb of Frankston. He was a real mummy's boy, but he actually hated women other than his mum. He was a loser. He was a no-hoper. He was going nowhere. And so he confessed to all these murders and all the stalking he did. He said he hated women and he wants them all fucking dead. And he's never shown any remorse in and those are his words. He said he had to kill three to get the serial killer title. That's what he told someone who wrote to him in prison once. Now, over 7 weeks in 1993, he escalated, despite the fact that since he was a child, he'd cut the family cat's throat. He had cut his sister's throats of his sister's teddy bears and things from the time he was a young kid. He never tried to better himself. He worked in a petrol station, gas station, as you guys call it in the States. He escalated in his teenage years to stalking women, harassing them. He stalked the sister of his neighbor, his next door neighbor, at her house. He cut her cat's throat. He wrote on her wall something like, "I'm coming for you, Donna." She was so scared she moved in with her sister. Unbeknownst to her, she was living at this point by moving in with her sister next door to the guy that was stalking her. He also stalked other women as well. One got away, and on the day that one of them got away, his thirst wasn't quenched. So he killed a woman called Elizabeth Stevens, who was 18. She was walking home from studying at the library, and he attacked her and cut her throat. He'd been showing people for years what he was going to do to women with cutting their throat, and same with those girls in Ecuador, and that's exactly what he started doing. No rape, as far as I know. There's a really great kind of podcast series about him, but there's also a kind of legendary true crime book here called The Frankston Murders. A couple of weeks later, the one that really cuts to my core was a 22-year-old new mum. By new mum, I mean she'd given birth 10 days before, Deborah Freem. She'd just come home from the hospital. She had a friend over while her partner was out working. She said, "Can you just stay with the baby while I pop out to get some milk at the milk bar, the corner store?" While she dropped into the corner store, because back then they weren't too worried about safety, she left her car door unlocked. Paul Denyer saw this. He crept into the back seat of the car, and when Deborah Freem got back in, he held a gun to her side. She freaked out. She started flashing and driving crazy, flashing her lights. People witnessed this. He then cracked it because she was doing this. He made her pull off on like a side road. He dragged her into, I'm just doing this from memory because I know this because it's Melbourne. He dragged her into bushland and cut her throat. And I could almost start crying thinking about her last moments because her little boy, baby Jake, was 10 days old at home. And this is the person they want out on the streets. And I get really affected by it. Jake, if you want to know what happened to him, it's a tale as old as time. Paul Denyer, as Jake says, not only took his mum's life, but he took his dad's life and Jake's life. Jake grew up with a dad who was completely destroyed by what happened to his beloved partner, Deborah. He turned to drugs and alcohol. He then moved them interstate to try to give Jake a better life. And one day while he was out on his dirt bike, he fell off a cliff and he became a quadriplegic by snapping his neck. He then died as a result of that. And Jake says it was all downhill because of what happened to Deborah's mum. Jake then had no parents. He turned to drugs and alcohol. He lived on the streets. He had next to no life. And only recently, and he's only a couple of years younger than me, he's in Melbourne. He's trying to make his life better. And people have opened up their homes to him and got him on sure footing. And if you care anything about little baby Jake, who was 10 years old, please, I'm sorry, I'm upset, but please pause this and Google Paul Denyer, D-E-N-Y-E-R, and sign that petition for at least Deborah Freem. The third one is Natalie Russell. She was walking home from school. He dragged her through a hole that he'd cut in a barbed wire fence and he cut her throat. All of these people's parents are still alive, and we have a wonderful politician here, which those two words don't generally go together, David Limbrick, who has been very vocal about this. I followed him for years just for his politics, but he was Natalie Russell's boyfriend at the time when Natalie was killed. Now, Paul Denyer not only confessed to all this and showed no remorse for 30 years, but he is also the prime suspect in the murder of a young woman called Sarah McDermid, who disappeared after getting off the train to go home at Cannanook Station in Melbourne, which is not far from where I grew up. And he is the prime suspect. And I firmly believe that Paul Denyer was responsible, as do the police. Sarah McDermid has never been found. And there is a great podcast series about Sarah McDermid. She was born in Scotland, and one day I'll do an episode on her because I want to draw attention to this. She then moved to Australia with her family, and someone killed her, and I believe that person is Paul Denyer, just like police do, just like other people do, but he's never confessed to it. Former guards who have dealt with him said that he'll get out and he'll kill again immediately, and I don't think the people... I hope that I will give you a good update this week or next week or whatever regarding the fact that they've shut him down, because as forums of women who are worried about this online say they're openly worried, and I'm worried because I live in the southeast. Paul Denyer is a dumb, oafish loser, creature of habit who will return to the area he knows, which is the southeast, and go and look at pictures of him. He's changed a bit since he's been in prison, but familiarise yourself with him and make his life hell. If he lives next door to you in Australia, we're not allowed to defend ourselves and not allowed to carry mace. When we're obviously, everyday people don't have guns. I have a personal protection alarm. That is the extent of the legalities. We do not have a registered sex offender list that people can access to see if someone is living next door to them who is one. Crims are generally pitted above the average person, and unfortunately, this week, potentially on Tuesday, Paul Denyer could be out on the street after everything I just told you. And I really hoped that prison justice would sort him out. I think about him often, and I believe he's been in protective custody. Otherwise, someone would have sorted him out. Now, I'm not saying if you're in the underworld or something in Melbourne that you should kind of do something about this, but I'm also not saying that because the justice system is failing us. And if you don't believe me, go and listen to when I listed all of the cases, many of them in Melbourne, especially in recent years, on the Toy Accordingly thing. And I'm very passionate about this. And if there's a protest or something, if he gets out, I'll be front and center. So keep your eyes peeled for that, because I'm not fucking around when it comes to this shit. The next one is also a petition that I think if you're in the States, you should sign. I have, and I think anyone should. This is just as unjust as what I just talked about and riles my blood just as much. US authorities will not seek charges in death of Shanquella Robinson in Mexico. Now, if you remember a few months ago, a video went around online that the perpetrators posted of a young black woman who went to Mexico with her friends on holiday. They went to Cabo. And a video went up of another young woman bashing the shit out of her, essentially murdering her, like live on TV, while a man, I say that very loosely, says, "Why won't you fight back?" in the background while he's filming it. The world has turned to shit, and live streaming, you know, killings or putting the stuff online, like people are just so desensitized, so morally corrupt, so repulsive, so many people. That I just sometimes I have no words for what I see. But Shanquella, her friends then upped and went back to the United States. Shanquella, the autopsy in Mexico said that she died of a broken neck. You can literally, I'm sorry, but you can see it happen in the video when you watch it. She was bashed to death by one of her so-called friends because girls are becoming just as violent and psychotic as men can act. Because of, I think, just things that they've been told in their lives and things that they've seen, you know, they think, "Oh, I'm going to be a tough bitch." I think you should be more worried generally about other women when you're a woman than men. But they went back to the States. Then they did the autopsy in Mexico, and then they did an autopsy when she was returned her body to the United States. That autopsy, for some reason, says she didn't have a broken neck, which I don't believe at all. I believe they're just passing the buck. I think they're lying. I think the FBI is lying, which isn't surprising. They've now told her family they're not going to press charges. And if you're confused by how they'd be able to, because American citizens killed an American citizen clearly in Mexico, I want to direct you to the episode I did on Carolyn Abel, which specifically talks about the law that's unique to America, where you can be charged for killing another American abroad. So, of course, the FBI can in fact do that, because if they ever decide to arrest that wench that killed Carolyn Abel, they can charge her just like they did with the American guy who on his honeymoon killed his girlfriend out here in Australia when they were scuba diving. So they're totally able to. They just don't want to. They just want to pass the buck. They're too busy watching you online, guys, like the FBI. More agents every year just watching what you're saying, make sure you don't offend anyone. But, you know, they're just going to let Americans kill other Americans on foreign soil and not do anything. This is kind of a twist on what we'd normally talk about with Mexico passing the buck. It's kind of turned it on its head, where Mexico is like, "No, we'll charge her." And America's like, "Oh, no, we won't." So these girls are monsters. Go and watch Shanquella's mum speak. Honestly, she can come on the podcast if she wants to. I feel such a massive connection to her. She's just a tough woman who loved her daughter. Please Google the petition started by their family to force the FBI to press charges what is clearly the murder of Shenquella Robinson in Mexico. And if you can stomach it, watch what her friends did to her, this girl. And if that's not a murder on film, I don't know what is. And it's widely available out there. Shenquella, her name is spelled S-H-A-N-Q-U-E-L-L-A. And it's Robinson, R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N. Please go and sign the petition. These things do work. They do affect change when people see that people are not happy. So please go and do that. And just be wary of the people you're friends with. I know that it probably wasn't going to help Shenquella. I actually honestly have a feeling that they lured her down there to do that and then leave. I don't know why. It's just always been my gut feeling since that happened. I just have no words. But between the injustice with Paul Denyer and the FBI not pressing charges, you know, people have their priorities all wrong. So please look her up. The final story that I have for you, but it brings us back to Australia, and it may not mean a lot to a lot of people, like the Paul Denyer one won't, but it's one of those headlines that when I saw it, it hit me in the heart. You know, I felt a massive lump in my throat because I think of this man so often. It's probably the number one case in the world that I've always felt, yeah, if anyone deserves justice and for answers, please give it to these people. So the headline was on a really good missing persons website in Australia called Leave the Light On, which does amazing work. And they wrote just yesterday, actually, the day before when I recorded part one, I logged off and then I saw this and I thought about it all day. It said, Jim, sorry to inform you that Jim Beaumont has unfortunately passed away without ever knowing what happened to his children. I just really felt it. So Jim Beaumont was the father of the three Beaumont children. I've heard it covered quite a lot on US podcasts and British podcasts. So maybe a number of you are familiar. On Australia Day, January 26, 1966, Jane Arner and Grant Beaumont went to Glenelg Beach in Adelaide because it was a boiling hot day, and they vanished and they were never seen again. And Sicko obviously got them, you know, they were witnessed with a stranger, you know, and it was an early example of when Australians, they often cited as Australians, started to wake up to the fact that there's psychos, you know, there's people who mean bad. Things were different back then. Kids went to the beach by themselves. And I've often tried not to think about what happened to them, but my mind has always gone to their parents, Jim and Nancy, who had to live very long lives actually afterwards, in this incredible grief. Nancy, I believe, was sedated for quite a long time afterwards. In photos, she's essentially propped up when it first happened. She had to talk to the media. Nancy died a couple of years ago. She was 92. Jim died a few days ago. He was 97. And I've often kind of talked to my mum, do you think that's a curse or a blessing living that long with that trauma? They eventually split up, you know, obviously, and they never had any other kids. And with Jim Beaumont dying this week, every link to those kids is gone. No one's actively looking. I mean, it's an open case. It's actually our oldest open case. And a couple of years ago, we really thought there might be movement in it, but it was just bullshit. There wasn't. And I don't think they'll ever solve it. I just believe it was an early, you know, there's always been psychos around, but it was an early kind of child pedophile groomer who, I have a lot of theories on it and I'll never get into it because it doesn't fit this podcast, but someone who kind of groomed them when they would go to the beach during the summer, with a number of things that happened in that case that seemed weird when the parents thought back on it and start. So Jim is gone, Nancy's gone, and all the kids are gone, and the whole family lineage is gone. And I just really wanted to talk about them because there's no other family left. They're all gone. Every member of that family, it's gone. And I just wanted to kind of say RIP Jim Beaumont. He was just a working class man, supporting his family in Adelaide, and loved his kids. And they were 4, 7, and 9, Jane, Anna and Grant, and never saw them again. And the pain of that, imagine one kid, let alone three, the pain that he lived with for the rest of his life, and to be either blessed with or cursed with such a long life, 97 and 92, both of them, My mum often said, I wonder if they're holding on, you know, to see if they can get answers. And yesterday I wrote to her and I said, Jim Beaumont is gone, and I just hope he got his answers. That's always been my thing. If there's another side, and I don't know, I hope that they were given the answers that they waited 60 years for, you know, such long lives in suffering. If there's another side, I hope that they were told what happened to their kids and they had those answers and maybe reunited with them, because it's just such a, it's one of our biggest cases ever, to the brazenness of taking three kids. I mean, one is enough. Like, three, that person is a lunatic, psycho. Anyway, that is my very heavy world headlines for this week. All right, no episode next week, as in this coming week. I'll be back the following week. I won't be on email. Sorry, guys, got too much like going on at the moment. If you do ever email, it may take me a while to get back to you. Not only do I get a lot of emails, but I have like a job, you know. Sorry. I'm probably dying of, you know, hypothermia or something, because I did get caught in a rainstorm earlier today and I was thinking about it. Become a patron at on the website, unknownpassagepodcast.com, it links to the Patreon. Join the community, support the community, fun and games in there. Not really, but I always have something going on, and that's where you can kind of learn each week about the cases, and I do polls, and I have Patron Pet of the Week, and I have Patreon-only mini-sodes. I'm planning on releasing another one next week just for patrons, though. And you support, you know, the community if you enjoy my work, because it's just me talking aloud to myself. If you want to give to the PayPal, it's unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com, and I'll give you a shout out. If with Patreon, $1 to $5 a month, you get a shout out. $5 and over a month, you get a choice for an upcoming episode. This was Kelly's from Sydney. Kelly requested something supernatural, which I don't think it really was, but from the exterior, you can see why it would be. It's very spooky. Holy shit. And yeah, I will be back when I'm back. Yeah, I don't really have anything to say. Next time, it literally is an all new case, all new place. That's another reason I have to take next week off, because I have to learn like a whole new place that I'm not familiar with. And I was thinking about how funny it is that I crammed so hard in high school for my final history exams that I still have nightmares about. And I've intentionally every week put myself through that, learning a new case in a new place. So shout out to my history teacher, Heather. Maybe it's her reason, like she was the reason why I do this sadistic shit to myself every week, or, you know, masochistic stuff to myself every week by having to learn an entire background of not only someone but a place as well. So stay tuned for that, and yeah, we'll be going there. Speak soon. Bye.